Hello and welcome to NewsHour live from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Rebecca Kesby and we begin in Hong Kong where elections are underway today to choose members of the Legislative Council or LegCo. There are 161 candidates fighting for 90 seats, but all of them have been approved to run based on their loyalty to the government in Beijing. Hong Kong is a special administrative region of China following decades as a British colony. Well, these elections are only the second since sweeping changes to the electoral system were put into place after pro-democracy protests in 2019. And today's vote is taking place as many Hong Kongers are still in shock after a devastating fire at a housing complex killed more than 150 people just over a week ago. It's the worst such fire in the territory for more than 70 years. Well, the BBC's Martin Yip is at a polling station in the Tai Po district where that fire happened and joins us live. Martin, first, let's get a word on the turnout because I noticed in the last LegCo vote, I think that was 2021, it was very far down, the lowest ever, around 30%. Have we got any idea of what the turnout is today?
Well, yes, indeed, that was what happened in 2021 after the first poll, after the shake-up of the system by Beijing. And tonight, as I talk to you now, is now standing at over 29%, 29.06 to be precise. And we're still waiting for an update from the previous half hour. It's not out as I kept refreshing my phone for that very figure. So it's still 1 percentage point shy of that of last year. So
fairly
something
low,
that
though,
the government
would
keep a very... very low indeed, and in that sense, the government will keep a close eye on it.
Well, as I mentioned, you're in the district where that terrible fire claimed so many lives. The leader, John Lee, has ordered an inquiry to get to the bottom of what went wrong. But it seems there's still a lot of anger about how the whole thing's been handled.
Well, let's put things this way. As we speak, we understand that where I'm standing now, if I can tell you that first, is just 10 minutes walk or 15 minutes walk from the ferry fire scene. And there's a little garden standing next to it where people are still queuing up to lay flowers, and that makeshift shrine or memorial is expected to end by midnight tonight. So that can tell you what the city is feeling. We also managed to speak to some voters who are still willing to speak. Some did say that this fire has changed their mind, that they've decided to come and cast their vote instead, despite of the fact that this election is heavily vetted. All the candidates have went through a vetting process that proves they are all patriots to China.
We understand that the authorities actually called in foreign press for a briefing yesterday ahead of the vote today. Is that normal, and do we know what they said in that briefing?
I guess for those who work in mainland China, the journalists who are stationed in Beijing, it's more common that they might face these from time to time from the foreign ministry. But this time it's the same thing being done by the Office for Safeguarding National Security. That's a Beijing-imposed anti-spying agency in Hong Kong. It is also a law enforcement for national security. And if my memory serves, this is really the first time that such things happen so publicly. They did publish a statement saying that they have summoned foreign media organizations to hear this. And it's a very stark warning telling them not to interfere with China's affairs. And they accused foreign media yet again for spreading false information during their firefighting efforts.
And just briefly, I mean, has that meant that journalists maybe like you are operating under restrictions then? Can you explain that?
They didn't make any clear reference to what we can do, what we can't do, other than the fact that anything that is deemed to be trying to overthrow the Chinese state, they will press the law. But otherwise, it seems to be things are still normal, and they somehow claim that freedom of press can go side by side with upholding national security.
OK, Martin, thanks so much for that update live from Hong Kong, the BBC's Martin Yip. Well, David Rennie is geopolitics editor at The Economist magazine. Until last year, he was the bureau chief in Beijing. He joins us live. David, just first, a quick word on that briefing that Martin was telling us about yesterday. Do you think that is significant, and could it impact how this story is covered?
It was very sinister. The foreign media called in were told that the Office of National Security reserves the right to take necessary measures to strengthen the management of foreign media. So it was a clear warning. They were told, you have been warned. And I think the kind of the irony is that the warning that was handed out to foreign media was that it would be outrageous, if you like, to link public anger about the government's response to the fires and the LegCo elections that are underway today. But by putting those in the same statement and telling the media the last thing you must do is link the government's aftermath work in the fire to the LegCo elections, they're clearly making the link themselves. They're showing that that is what they're frightened about, is that turnout in this election will be linked to public anger about how these fires were handled.
There has been a lot of anger, as you say. There have been quite a lot of arrests, about 13 in connection to the fire. Most of those people were construction workers or involved in that, I think. There were also arrests around people who'd organised an online petition and also some people who had urged others not to vote today. And we heard there from Martin talking about the low turnout, around 29% at the moment. Do you think the fire could have an impact on these elections?
I mean, what we're seeing is the mainland playbook. So I spent 10 years in total working in mainland China, and the government and authorities were incredibly sensitive when there was any kind of disaster, a train crash or a fire that killed lots of ordinary people. And they would immediately flood the zone, and they were always on the lookout for people trying to organize and sort of get people together who were just instinctively upset because their families, their loved ones had been hurt. In the mainland, that's absolutely the norm. In Hong Kong, as your correspondent said, it's very new and it's incredibly sensitive when these elections are presented as proof that Hong Kong has an accountable government and that this new all-patriotic, vetted parliament, mini-parliament, is more efficient than the more democratic version that came before. Well, if people don't want to vote for it and they're having to threaten journalists not to make the link with public anger over the fire, I think the authorities are admitting, though they don't want to say it, that there clearly is a link, and this is a much more mainland version of Hong Kong than we've seen before.
Just briefly, on the position of John Lee, the leader, he's ordering an independent investigation into the fire, but how would you assess his own political situation at the moment? Does he still have the backing of Beijing?
Beijing's in a bit of a bind because they chose someone who's a former policeman, that's his background, and they told him to stress national security above all. And Beijing can hardly complain that the former policeman told to get on with national security has made that his main theme. Now, if he's now unpopular with the people, it's on Beijing to decide whether they themselves made a mistake. But they can't complain about a former policeman doing exactly what he was told to do, which is put national security at the very heart of everything he does.
Very good to speak to you, David Rennie. Thanks so much for joining us. That's David Rennie, geopolitics editor at The Economist magazine. Now, let's turn to Africa, because earlier this morning there was an attempted military coup in the West African state of Benin. The government says its forces thwarted the attempt and are totally in control of the situation, but not before a group of soldiers took over the national TV broadcaster and, live on air, claimed that they deposed the president, Patrice Talon, and seized the control of the country. Here's a clip of that moment.
Le comité militaire pour la refondation CMR.
The Military Committee for Refoundation has decided that the Constitution of November 2025 is now suspended. All the institutions are dissolved. Political parties and all political activities have been suspended until further notice. And the land, air and sea borders of Benin are closed until further notice.
Well, there have been a number of coups in West Africa in the past couple of years, including about a week ago in nearby Guinea-Bissau, though there hasn't ever been one, it seems, in Benin. The country is due for elections this coming April. Let's get more details now with Beverly Ochieng, who's a senior political analyst at Control Risks in Dakar, Senegal. Beverly, welcome to the programme. What do we know happened in Benin this morning? Because it does seem a little bit confused. Was it a real coup attempt?
Well, Rebecca, it seems it was very tentative, given the fact that the government was able to assert control very quickly afterwards. As we speak now, we understand that at least a dozen people have been arrested in connection with this coup attempt, including some military officers and a former military officer. They seem not to have as much consolidation. There were no mass protests, and I think they were trying to tap into prevailing political grievances going into that election that you just mentioned to try and stoke unrest. But the government has assessed that it is in control. It's still worth watching and seeing what happens, whether there'll be protests, a purge, support for the military or support for Talon, as it seems as if there are divisions that are emerging in the security forces.
Right. So it's not clear then what the motivation might have been. I mean, I mentioned there's been several coups in the region in the past few years, some more consequential than others. Can you sort of point out some of them, the more important ones?
Yeah, I mean, from 2020, there's been nearly 8 military coups in the region. The key ones have been in the Sahel, Mali, Burkina Faso and Niger, triggered both by political instability, but also as a result of ongoing grievances over elections that have taken place and insecurity. Then you have the most recent one that took place in Guinea-Bissau during the election. There was a bit of a lacuna which allowed the military to take power. Many of the people who are actually in the transition are allies of the president who had been deposed. There were much less critical coups in Gabon that took place during an election, removing Ali Bongo, who had and his family been in power for decades. There was also in Guinea, which is preparing to hold elections in December, a military took power after a constitutional mandate had been passed, extending presidential powers and the term for the then president, Alpha Conde.
And in terms of other factors behind the sort of shifting powers in the region, there is quite a bit of concern about the influence of Russian mercenaries operating in some of these countries, especially in the Sahel region.
Well, certainly. I mean, Benin has always been quite a beacon of stability, despite the fact there's been grievances over the years in the latter years of Talon's presidency. The government is considered to be quite close to the West. This has led to contention, particularly with the Sahel. Niger closed its borders with Benin in 2023 after the coup because of allegations that Benin is hosting French forces planning to destabilize the country. Russia made an entry into Niger. They have taken advantage of that space. And in instances, the disinformation being spread about countries like Benin, Nigeria, and other pro-Western Economic Community of West African States members are seen to be coming from those Russian networks. If this coup had, you know, taken place and perhaps it was a pro-Sahelian military coming into place, there would be concerns that this sort of Cold War taking place between Russia and pro-Western West African countries would extend into Benin.
Interesting stuff. Thank you so much for joining us live on the line. That's Beverly Ochieng there, senior political analyst at Control Risks, which is a think tank there based, she is, in Dakar, Senegal. Stay with us. Lots more to come from NewsHour. Still to come, the Oscars are still several months away, but one film that's been generating considerable interest is the Norwegian drama Sentimental Value.
It's about people who might never be that close, but at the end of the film, they have maybe taken an important step closer and they understand each other better. And I feel that kind of feeling is important right now.
More on that to come, and our headlines this hour. Russia has welcomed President Trump's new security strategy, describing it as largely consistent with Moscow's vision. Also, a coup attempt in the West African country of Benin has failed, as we've been hearing, and investigators in India are combing through the burnt-out ruins of a nightclub fire in Goa. At least 25 people have died, and we'll have more on that in a few minutes. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. Next to what many consider to be one of the biggest unanswered questions out there, are we really alone in the universe? Age of Disclosure is a new feature-length documentary featuring interviews with dozens of high-ranking officials in the United States talking about the possibility of UFOs in our skies. The film covers secret government efforts to study what these objects are, spotted by credible military pilots, and how the US Congress is now trying to get to the bottom of the mystery. The film is available to rent online, and the BBC's Tim Smith caught up with the director, Dan Farah, to hear more about what it reveals.
There's a whole fleet of them. Look on the ASA.
My gosh.
What you're hearing now comes from a video released by the US Department of Defense in 2020, showing a disc-shaped object turning slowly on its axis, that the Pentagon described as an unidentified aerial phenomenon, or a UAP.
We're going against the wind. The wind's 120 knots to the west.
A year later, President Obama backed up claims by US Navy pilots who went on the record saying they'd witnessed objects also captured on radar that flew in ways that defied the known laws of physics.
There's footage and records of objects in the skies that we don't know exactly what they are. We can't explain how they moved.
Now a new documentary, Age of Disclosure, seeks to get to the bottom of the UAP mystery. Dan Farrer is the director.
I interviewed 34 high-level members of the U.S. government, military, and intelligence communities. Everyone interviewed in the film has direct knowledge of the UAP issue as a result of their work for the U.S. government.
One of those in the film is the now U.S. Secretary of State and National Security Advisor Marco Rubio.
We've had repeated instances of something operating in the airspace over restricted nuclear facilities, and it's not ours, and we don't know whose it is. That alone, just that statement alone, deserves inquiry, deserves attention. Even presidents have been operating on a need-to-know basis, but that begins to ramp out of control. Some people claim it would cost them their lives if they spoke out about these things.
The Age of Disclosure features a number of impressive interviewees, like Lieutenant General James Clapper.
I served as the fourth Director of National Intelligence.
One of them, Brett Federson, a senior official during the Obama administration, makes a striking claim in the documentary's trailer.
Director of Aviation Security in the National Security Council, we are absolutely not alone.
Dan, why do you think people of this seniority are speaking out on this issue now?
They participated because they felt the public needed to know the base facts of this very urgent situation. And they're breaking their silence in this film with what they lawfully can disclose.
Age of Disclosure also tells the story of how the US Congress is now trying to get to the bottom of what videos like these might show.
Oh my gosh, dude.
There is an unprecedented bipartisan push in Congress to bring about disclosure of what the U.S. government knows about UAP and non-human intelligent life. There are three core leaders in Congress, Senator Rounds, who's a Republican, Senator Schumer, and Senator Gillibrand, who are Democrats. The three of them have co-sponsored an historic piece of legislation called the UAP Disclosure Act. And they are actively fighting to get that signed into law by the end of this year. The hope is that this film helps rally the support that they need to get that piece of legislation over the line.
And Dan, beyond national security and the obvious curiosity that people might have, why is it worth Congress trying to investigate UAPs and the alleged secrecy surrounding them?
Something else that the interview subjects in my film reveal is that this technology that UAP are displaying is so far superior to any technology we have that leaning into researching it and studying it more could lead to tremendous technological progress and impact the way we live.
Director Dan Farrer ending that report by Tim Smith. Next to Goa in western India, where at least 25 people have been killed in a fire at the Birch nightclub in Bagga. It's thought the fire began in the kitchen area at about 1 o'clock in the morning. But for the latest details, I've been speaking to the BBC's Davina Gupta in Delhi.
So the initial report suggests that there was a gas explosion in the kitchen of this club, and that led to intense smoke, and then the fire just spread across the venue. On the first floor, though, there was a party that was going on. It's a dance party that was happening, and there are videos of a belly dancer which was performing to a crowd, and there was a live band behind her when they started to notice the fire that spread out. And the initial reports also suggest that there was a congested passageway. So essentially people could not move out smoothly or exit that venue immediately. And because of poor ventilation, there are indications that people actually suffocated to death. We've also given to understand from the authorities that they found most of those bodies in the kitchen, which indicates that the staff members could not survive this explosion. There were some bodies on the stairway, a lead to the first floor, which suggests that it would have been difficult for people inside to get out. Out of the 25 people who've been confirmed dead so far, at least three people were tourists. We don't know their nationalities as of now, but that place, it seems from the eyewitnesses' account, was packed because it's a nightclub. It's in an area which is extremely popular for nightlife, for tourists who come to this beachfront. This state is next to the Arabian Sea and it's a popular tourist destination, and this is the peak tourist season.
Davina, I mean, you mentioned the number that we know have been killed. There are some people still in hospital as well. I think that could be for smoke inhalation and some other injuries as well. But what are the authorities saying about this establishment? Because there are some questions, I think, as to what you were mentioning there in terms of the fire escape routes and that sort of thing. I know Goa's chief minister has been talking about this today.
Yes, one of the main questions now is whether the venue was operating fully within its approvals, especially because it sits inside an eco-sensitive zone. So here the rules on construction and commercial activity are extremely tight. So authorities are verifying whether this club had valid occupancy licenses, whether a fire safety audit was done, and under what circumstances it was operating. They're also looking at whether any temporary extensions were added for the tourist season without clearance. As I mentioned, this is a strip just right next to the Arabian Sea of clubs. It's an extremely popular tourist spot, and club owners usually construct temporary installations just ahead of the tourist season, and these installations often do not have the required licenses, which also lead to a difficult part of crowd management if any kind of tragedy like the one that we have seen happens. So that's what is going to be under investigation. We also know from the authorities they're going to conduct a safety check of most of the nightclubs in that area, and this could also mean that going ahead in this tourist season, these clubs, some of them might not be allowed to operate.
Right, so that could have an economic impact on local businesses then?
Absolutely, because this part of Goa is known for affordable nightlife. So it would mean that going ahead, these club owners have to ensure that they're complying with the safety norms in the state. The opposition parties have been alleging that a lot of times these clubs are given licenses through corrupt practices. So that would also come under scanner. And if the onus is on the ruling Hindu Nationalist Party, the BJP, which is in power in the state as well, to prove the processes under which these clubs are operating. For now, an FIR has been registered against this particular club's owner, who's not been arrested so far. But the final report, once it comes out, will also tell us what exactly led to the fire.
The BBC's Davina Gupta there. And we've just had some more information from the police in Goa saying 21 of the dead are workers at the restaurant, 4 are tourists from Delhi, and all in the same family. It seems most of the deaths are because of suffocation, because of the smoke, rather than burn injuries. That just in from the Goan police. Welcome back to NewsHour. The Oscars ceremony doesn't take place till March, but the Movie World's awards season has begun in earnest this week with film awards in London and New York, and much of the focus has been on recognising independent cinema, as Tom Brooke reports.
London's Roundhouse is where the latest phase in movie awards season kicked off. At the British Independent Film Awards, there was excitement over the stories generated by independent cinema. Praise came from actor Emily Watson.
It's really great to see that people are striking out and, you know, using a voice that's truly independent, asking awkward questions.
Hi.
The picture Pillion took home 4 prizes at the British Independent Film Awards. Its screenplay was also recognised at the Gotham Awards in New York.
How do you get a man like that?
I have an aptitude for devotion.
It's a story of submission and dominance between two men, starring Alexander Skarsgård as a leather-clad biker. It's seen as a thought-provoking, boundary-pushing film. And Skarsgård gives credit to the independent film community in the UK for getting the project off the ground.
It's a small film about a subculture that's not often depicted on screen, especially not in this way. So the fact that the movies like Pilly can still get made makes me happy, at least. Yeah.
Akinola Davis won the Best Director trophy at the British Independent Film Awards for My Father's Shadow, centred on family relationships involving 2 young brothers and their father at a pivotal time in Nigeria in 1993.
Daddy, are you okay?
The film is the UK's official submission in the Oscars race. It also picked up two Gotham Awards. It's a British-Nigerian film praised for its authenticity. Akinola Davis sees himself as part of a new generation of British filmmakers.
We're able to make films that reflect ourselves from an honest point of view. I think they're really important for all the communities here in the UK.
My father is a really good director. But he's a very difficult person. We can't really talk.
And one film getting considerable early award season attention is the Norwegian picture Sentimental Value, seen as a perceptive and finely crafted family drama with strong acting. It's expected to feature prominently in pre-Oscar contests. Eskil Vogt co-wrote the screenplay.
It's about people who might never be that close, but at the end of the film, they have maybe taken an important step closer and they understand each other better. And I feel that kind of feeling is important right now.
These early awards are taking place at a challenging time for mainstream cinema and independent filmmaking. Independent directors often maintain they can't get sufficient funds for their projects or distribution, and cinema going still hasn't returned to pre-COVID levels. But at least in the realm of original creative storytelling, independent cinema seems to be thriving.
And that's Tom Brook with that report. Do stay with us. Lots more to come here on NewsHour. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC. I'm Rebecca Kesby. This week marks the one-year anniversary of the fall of the Assad regime in Syria. On December the 8th last year, Bashar al-Assad fled the capital, Damascus, shortly before rebel forces that had been sweeping across the country arrived in the city. He now lives in Russia. Bashar al-Assad had ruled the country since the year 2000, taking over from his father, Hafez, who'd been in power since 1971. The brutal put-down of a pro-democracy uprising in 2011 led to a bloody civil war, and Syrians found themselves even further from democracy than ever. Well, the BBC's chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, is in the Syrian capital, Damascus, and joins us live. Lise, give us an update on what's happened over the past year since that overthrowing of Assad. Can Syrians look to a more positive future now?
Well, Rebecca, I'm speaking to you. You might just hear the beeping of horns. I'm just on a balcony overlooking an iconic square in the heart of Damascus. It's where thousands and thousands of Syrians rushed in to celebrate on December the 8th last year, when the news broke all of a sudden that Bashar al-Assad, as you say, had fled to Russia. And now there's been a party, a massive street party going on for days, goes long into the night, I can tell you that. All of us being woken up by firecrackers at 4 a.m. And the big, big party will be tomorrow. And when you speak to Syrians, first of all, they say they're still, at least those we meet here in the heart of the capital, that they're, and I think it's the general feeling, is that they're just glad that the 50 years of a brutal rule by the Assad family is over. The grievous civil war has ended. But of course, all is not perfect. They certainly feel freer now. People have been freed from the prisons. People feel they can speak out more. But when I went down to the square, I chatted to Syrians to get a sense of what there is to celebrate and what more they want to change. Just to this man I spoke to about the significance of this time.
Today it is a historic day for everybody in Syria and for everybody in the world, because Bashar Assad committed a genocide against the humanity.
Has your life got better in the last year?
Yeah, but we have a lot of challenges. Our economy was destroyed, but we should be optimistic about the future of my country.
And Lee, so many people have been displaced by all the chaos you mentioned of the past few years. Have you come across many who have made the decision to return back?
Yes, UNHCR, the UN's refugee agency, says there's 3 million Syrians either living abroad or displaced inside the country have come home, although many are finding there's no home to return to because large swathes of this country lie in ruin. And the daily situation is still not improved much. There's still power cuts every day. There's still water shortages. But I have to say that everywhere we go, we do meet Syrians who are returning, some for just a visit, some to stay. And I ran into this one family, again, in the heart of that square, just below where I'm speaking to you from.
We're celebrating the day of Syria. We're celebrating liberation, the freedom, the liberation, the happiness for Syria. That day we waited for like years and years.
Okay. And you live in Syria now?
At the moment we live in UK, okay? I wish
so you've just come
soon.
Back for this yes. day.
We just came for that day, okay, with the family.
Your daughter?
So, yes, my daughter.
Is this your first time in Syria?
I used to come here when I was really little, but during the war I couldn't come down. I currently live in the UK. I'm studying there in university, yeah.
Has it changed enough for you to move back from the UK to Syria?
Definitely. If my family was ready, just because we have kids, because they have university, they have schools, that will be difficult for them. It's not fair for them. Okay. But otherwise, yes.
So briefly, Lise, I mean, the new government has many challenges as it takes over after a year.
Yes, and one of the biggest ones is knitting this country together in its sectarian divisions. If I was speaking to you from the coast in the minority Alawite area where there was huge violence in March, that you'd hear a different story. If you were in the south where months ago there was violence among the Druze, hundreds killed there, there is fear. And President al-Sharra is being told you have to do more to make everyone in Syria feel they are safe here.
All right, for the time being, Lise Doucette, thank you so much for joining us live there. We'll get more from Lise in the coming days. And as Lise was saying there, so many Syrians have been displaced over the past few years in the chaos that Syria has endured. And it's been a very difficult decision to make for many, whether to return or not. We've been speaking to two Syrians who grappled with that decision. Abdul Karim Ekzayeze is a doctor who's now living in Damascus, having moved back to Syria this year, and Zina Kanawate is the Senior Communications Officer for the Women for Women International NGO. She's based in the German capital, Berlin, and is thinking of returning to Syria. Owen Bennett-Jones has been speaking to them both, and Abdul Karim began by saying why he originally had to leave the country.
So when Aleppo was split between the regime and the oppositions, I had to move in between the both areas to work both in a governmental area on one side and in a field hospital in a basement of a mosque on the other side. So when this person whispered to me that the security agencies are looking for me, this meant to me that I will be arrested and I might be killed under torture, similar to two other friends who faced the same fate. So I went straight out of the operation theater. I changed my clothes. I dressed as like a normal civilian. I shaved my beard just to change the way I look. And then I sat next to a patient pretending that, you know, I'm just a normal civilian. So the security agencies, they scrutinized every single corner in the hospital for about 2 hours. And when they finished, it was about like midnight. Then that's when I decided I should not be in a regime held areas anymore. So I left the hospital. I sneaked out, actually. I went to my in-law's house and I decided I need to leave.
So you got away from the hospital and then basically, to cut a long story short, you ended up in London.
Yes, actually, yeah. So I was able to get away from that situation. So I decided to leave to the opposition held areas. At that point, I had no plan to leave the country. But then I worked in field hospitals in the opposition held areas in Northwest. I participated in the public health programs like the polio and the measles eradication campaigns. I worked with Save the Children. So, and then I got a scholarship, actually, to continue my education. So I traveled to London in 2016.
And you, I should say, succeeded in London. You studied and you did very well in London. But you took this decision to go back to Syria. And we're about to hear from Zeina Kanawati, who is making the decision as to whether she should go back. So tell us about your experience of returning.
So after the operation, I made 3 visits to Syria where I was assessing the situation. And I was keen to go back to witness these historical moments that the country is going through. So I went back to London again and I discussed with my wife, even my little daughters. I have 3 daughters, 10, 8 and 2. Though the 10 and 8, I discussed with them about our plans to go back to Syria. They were a bit hesitant. But then I thought, let's go back during summer and visit. So we went back in July. They really enjoyed being in Syria during the summer between Aleppo, Homs, Damascus and Idlib. So we decided, let's give it a try. So we stayed. And now we've been about like 4 months here. Where we live is very stable in Damascus. And the services were slightly better than I imagined. And also the security situation in Damascus is good. But again, I think in other governorates, things are slightly unstable. But I think broadly, things are going in the right direction.
Well, it's very interesting to hear your story. And it must be of interest to Zaina Kanawati, as I said, who's thinking about this. And you've been away from Syria since 2007, so it's a long time. But as I understand it, you are thinking of going back. What do you think of what you've just heard?
Actually, I have visited Syria for the first time this year in 10 years to visit my family, because during the past 10 years, I was not able to go back because of my work as a journalist against the previous regime. So this year when I went back, I felt that, yes, I want to go back to my country, but I also didn't feel very well to bring back my children there, to be honest.
Right. And I mean, the doctor's done it. Might you think about it?
Yeah, I mean, it's different for everyone because you cannot just go back after being outside your country for 10 years or more. Mm-hmm. It's not an easy decision to make, you know, to change the whole life. And especially that I don't feel that the infrastructure is reliable there. And there are still so many security and safety issues that I'm waiting a little bit to see how it's going to develop.
Okay, Doctor, what would you say to Zaina as she's thinking about this?
So I had very similar issues to consider. But I think, as I mentioned, I was slightly surprised that the infrastructure in some areas is much better than I imagined. So in the area where I live, I get better services than the ones I used to get in London, really, in terms of electricity, water, healthcare, education for the kids. There are some differences and some challenges, especially when it comes to schooling, the different educational systems. But I think the services are much better than I expected.
Zaina, what would you want to ask the doctor for some reassurance on particular points?
As I told you, it depends on everyone's situation, because he might be really centered in a good place in Damascus. But where I went to visit my family, we didn't have water for, like, it comes every 3 days for 2 hours. It wasn't enough even for three people. And the electricity was really cutting so much. So I'm not quite sure yet. And also, I need to add on top of this, the situation for women in Syria is not specifically what I'm hoping for yet.
Doctor, let's just deal with that last point. You've got a wife and three daughters, you said. How are they finding it?
So, as I mentioned initially, they were very hesitant. I think they are enjoying the social life in Syria, which is very enjoyable for them. But I do agree with Zaina that in some locations, it's better than the others. And to be honest, it might be very costly to ensure that those services are available in some of the areas. While the majority of the country, they do not have this infrastructure, or it's not available. It's not affordable for all people. And that's why I think for people who have maybe their income from outside the country, it might be easier for them to go back.
Yeah, well, okay, there's the money issue. But just on Zaina's point about attitudes to women in Syria, have they noticed a big difference between, you know, their lives in London and their lives in Damascus?
To be honest, I was trying to put them in a protective environment so far, because, again, I was not going to risk them being exposed to an unprotected environment.
Yes, and Zaina, you might not want to be in a protected environment, I guess.
I mean, it's different for everyone, and I really respect Abdul Karim's experience there, but I feel also that it's a bit risky for a journalist who wants to really cover what's happening and who wants to move freely and be able to deliver the voices of especially women in Syria. So in this specific career I have, I don't feel safe in Syria yet.
That's Zaina Kanawati there. And we also heard from Abdul Karim Ekzayez. They were both speaking to the BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones about whether or not they should return to Syria. Just as we were listening to that, it's been announced that a dozen soldiers have been arrested in Benin after that coup attempt that we were reporting earlier in the programme. President Talon is reported to be safe. We're not quite sure where he is, but the government is saying they have full control. Soldiers are blocking access to the presidential compound at the moment. We'll keep across all developments there. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. Now listen up, Formula One fans. The final race of the season has got underway in Abu Dhabi Grand Prix, and it's going down to the wire on the last day of the Drivers' Championship. It's still up for grabs. Technically, it could go three ways between Max Verstappen of Red Bull and Lando Norris and Oscar Piastri, both of McLaren. Norris is the most likely contender, as he just needs to come third to win the championship. But the race has been going for about 45 minutes. The top three are still in the race, I'm told. But just before the race got underway, we spoke to Andrew Benson, the BBC F1 correspondent, who's there. How significant, then, is this race?
Well, it's the World Championship decider. It's the first three-way title decider in Formula One for 15 years. And the three championship contenders, Max Verstappen, Lando Norris and Oscar Piastri, have qualified together on the front row. So it promises drama, intensity, and who knows what else.
Well, Norris, I mean, he does seem to be the favourite, doesn't he? Just sort of statistically. How much of that is down to the car? Because I think Verstappen is considered to be the better driver, no?
Well, Norris has a 12-point lead over Verstappen and another 4 points over his teammate Oscar Piastri, the second McLaren driver. On average, the McLaren's been the fastest car over the year, certainly in qualifying, but they've won seven races each, so it's been a very even season. I think in Formula One, it's very widely regarded that Max Verstappen is the best overall, i.e. most complete driver. But of course, he's been around for a lot longer than Norris and Piastri. He's had time to develop. No one arrives in Formula One fully formed. But you'd kind of expect that. And it would be wrong to diminish Norris and Piastri just because Verstappen is perceived to be the best driver.
As you say, though, it's been a really good season for McLaren, hasn't it, with two drivers in contention. How unusual is it that they're both sort of in that position? And what's the relationship between the two?
Well, Formula One teams tend not to be able to manage this sort of situation. You either have a number one driver and a number two driver who's not as competent as him, who's just there as a support act if he's capable of doing it. Or you have two drivers who are on an equal level, and if they end up in a championship-winning car in that scenario, more often than not, and to a quite high level of percentage, they fall out. The atmosphere gets toxic. One of McLaren's greatest achievements this year, along with designing the best car on average, is that they've managed to control Norris and Piastri in their relationship in a way that has meant that hasn't happened. And that's down to clever management, a careful building of a particular culture, and getting the drivers to buy into the fact that the team is important, the team is there to back them, and that they want to be at the team for a number of years, and they want to be at the team for a number of years together, and therefore that it's in their best interests to allow the team to operate in this way.
It's a gripping finale. One thing Formula One has managed to do, which maybe some other sports haven't, is to grow the fan base over the past few years, with so many more young people and lots of women as well now really interested in the sport. How have they done that?
Well, I think it's a combination of a couple of things. The Netflix Drive to Survive series was important in that. It goes sort of behind the scenes into the personalities. And of course, the personalities in Formula One, as those of us who work in it know, they're so compelling. You know, these are the drivers, many of them very good looking, the team bosses, highly intelligent, manipulative, Machiavellian even in some cases. There's always some drama off the track. So and that's been portrayed in Netflix in a way that in the past it's only really been portrayed properly in the written media. And then you have the influence of social media. After Bernie Eccleston was ousted as the F1 impresario by Liberty Media when they bought the sport in 2017, this US media conglomerate, they opened up everybody's access to social media, and that's given a much wider audience a glimpse into what Formula One is and who the people in it are. And you combine those two things together, along with there's been some dramatic seasons as well in the last few years. The characters have really become public, and that's what I would say was the biggest reason behind the explosion of interest.
That's our F1 correspondent Andrew Benson there in Abu Dhabi. And I'm told at the moment Piastri is in the lead, Verstappen is next, then Norris is in third. Now, when you think of prison diaries, you might immediately think of Alexander Solzhenitsyn writing in the Soviet gulags, or maybe Nelson Mandela writing copious letters during his 27 years in jail. So will the prison diaries of former French President Nicolas Sarkozy also become a bestseller. Mr. Sarkozy was jailed for a full 3 weeks in October on charges of corruption. In the next few days, he'll be publishing his prison diary. Some extracts have been in the French press this weekend. Let's speak to Antonia Kerrigan, journalist with France 24, who's been looking at this. Welcome to the programme. He was only in for 3 weeks. Are we led to believe that he actually wrote this diary while in prison?
Well, we're told within the diary, of course, that he was kept to his room 23 hours a day and that his main occupations were reading and writing. We know that he went into prison with quite a hefty reading list. He brought both volumes of The Count of Monte Cristo and A Biography of Jesus Christ in with him. And then he wrote this memoir extremely quickly, and it was apparently finished within 10 days of his incarceration ending. He said that he showed the script to his wife. She agreed that it was excellent, and then he put it through the lawyers, who removed some of the descriptions that they found perhaps too incisive. But indeed, it's been an extremely quick turnaround. 213 pages, the journal of a prisoner. And of course, we'll be interested to see what else is in there. But certainly an extremely quick turnaround, very much making the most of those 20 days behind bars.
Right. Well, that would be my next question. I mean, is he looking for some sort of political gain out of this? What does he say in the extracts you've managed to read?
Well, certainly it does seem that way. It does seem that this is in many ways a plea for his innocence and his putting forward his case. He says, why were the prosecutors so quick to investigate him on the basis of certain documents? And he also says that in some circles, there is a minority pursuing a political fight against politicians, against the right wing, and against him, the symbol of those things. So there is very much him pleading his case within those pages, and certainly trying to set himself up as a sympathetic figure. He describes the bleakness of prison. He says he's struck by the lack of colour, that grey dominates and devours everything. He describes not having a window and having to wait for visits from his wife, Carla Bruni, for her to tell him about the weather. And although, of course, he was in the VIP section of the prison, that got a lot of press, the exact conditions of his incarceration were not like any other Tom, Dick or Harry, if you will, behind bars in France. He says that those that VIP treatment, in fact, meant increased security. And he says that wasn't a privilege, but another source of suffering. He also talks about what he subsisted on food-wise. It was essentially yogurt, cereal bars, and bottled water. This, of course, as he was frightened to eat the prison meals for fear of what the other inmates might have done. He says it was a real hostile environment.
Right. Antonia Kerrigan, thank you so much. Those prison diaries out this week.